messages from New Life Gillette series, Parenting 101. This week, Pastor Mike presents part one of this series.
Welcome. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors here at New Life. I want to say welcome to those of you who are watching online and to the guys over at the prison, to those of you who are here in the room. We're starting a new series today, and it's called Parenting 101. It's all about, I bet you can guess, that's right, money. Just kidding. No, it's all about parenting. You don't have to be a parent to get something out of it. We're going to make each of these messages applicable to everyone, including those of you who aren't parents, but you have parents, and I'm pretty sure that's all of us. And so we're going to talk about parenting for the next 4 weeks. And to be honest with you, I was quite scared of this series. Because when I first became a pastor at the age of 32, and I felt way overwhelmed, not to mention I was a pastor who had a one-year-old kid, and that was it. So what I know of parenting is this. I hate changing diapers. That's what I know about parenting. And I'm supposed to teach a series about parenting. When we first did this, we did a survey and asked people, what do you want to hear about? What do you want to learn about? What topics do you need to learn more about? And guess what number two on the list was? Parenting. So I decided, okay, I can't avoid the topic, so I'll just delay it. So anyway, we are here talking about parenting, and we've done a lot of preparation to get ready for this series. And there's one really cool thing about parenting when it comes to Christians is that we got a pretty awesome parent in common, all of us. God himself called himself our heavenly Father. And so we've got something to go on in this series. It's funny, when I first started planning this series, I started asking people if they would be on a parenting panel. So the fourth week of the series, we're just going to do a parenting panel, so I had to preach fewer messages on it. And so I asked the first person, and the first person said, I could tell you a lot of what not to do. And so I started looking for parents that had like adult children who had grown up and seemed like the parents did a pretty good job. And so I asked another person, they said, I don't feel like I did a good job at all. We just got lucky. And so I kept asking people. I think I asked like 12 people, and every single one of them either said, no way, I did terrible, or they didn't respond to me, or they said that I could tell you what not to do thing. And so one thing I found out about parenting is we're all pretty critical of our own parenting, right? And this isn't new to our generation. For generations, people have a hard time with parenting. It's because with parenting, nobody's ever ready to be a parent. Like when you become a parent, you can do some preparation and reading books. You read one book that says to do this. You read another book that says do the exact opposite thing. And you're like, nobody is really prepared. So you do a lot of trial and error, which implies you do a lot of error. Like you screw up a lot and you figure it out as you go along. But we are all on this journey together. So all of us, recognizing that we've screwed up in parenting, are joining together with an entire history of human beings who have screwed up in parenting. In fact, if you read the Bible, you'll notice that most of them screwed up pretty bad. It's pretty hard to find an example of a good family in the Bible. This is why when people tell me that I want to have a biblical family, I'm like, oh yeah, which one? Like, which family? Pick a family in the Bible that you would like to pattern your family after, because I have a hard time finding one. They're all pretty screwed up. Apparently, nobody knows how to parent. But here's what we're going to do for this series. We're going to take 4 weeks, and we're going to look at some of the things that are kind of eternally true to all parenting, some principles that are just true about parenting in general. Not specifics, because there's all these different theories about you should do this. Another person says you shouldn't do this. You should be strict. You should be lenient. You should give them room. You should be whatever. Everybody's got different opinions on those things. But we're going to look at some basic principles that are true about all of parenting. So why is parenting so important to talk about in church? And why would we pick a topic like that for sermons? Maybe that's like a Bible study thing, right? Well, let me tell you this. You are who you are in large part because of your parents. Maybe it's because you watched the way you lived your life and you said, I don't want to be anything like that, and you swung the pendulum in the exact opposite direction. Or maybe you just said you weren't going to be like your parents and you ended up being exactly like them. In a lot of our lives, you can tell who you are just by seeing who your parents are. This is true in my life. A lot of who I am because of my parents. I'll give you an example. My dad was a pastor. I'm a pastor. My dad was a pastor. His dad was a pastor. His four generations of pastors on both sides of my families are pastors. But it's not just my occupation that I picked because of my family. In fact, I grew up saying, I'm never going to be a pastor. Not going to do it. I hate it. God has a way of doing this. But a lot of who I am, including some of my attitude. So my dad is a pastor. I'll tell you a story. My dad is a pastor in a small town in Kansas, Mulvane, Kansas, and small church. And my dad, a big grace guy, has somebody on his board who's kind of semi-new to Christianity, but he's done a lot of growing recently. And so this guy on his board smoked. Dun-dun-dun. And so his boss, the district superintendent, comes in and says, you can't have somebody on your board that smokes. And so they actually called my dad into a district board meeting and reprimanded him and said, you got to get that guy off of your board. You can't have somebody on your board that smokes. And my dad said, listen, he's growing. He's getting there. This is a good guy. I like this guy. And so they go back and forth and they fight about whether or not this guy should be on the board because he smokes. And my dad, finally fed up, turns to him and said, you know, last time I checked, it's also a sin to overeat, but every single one of you are on your church boards. There were some rather large men on that board. Needless to say, my dad did not have that job much longer. He was fired. Yes, that happened. So that gives you a little bit of an insight about where I get my attitude from. But this is why it's important to talk about parenting, because we are who we are in large part because of our parents, which is pretty cool, because God himself chose to describe himself as our parent, our heavenly father. And how did he do this? Did God stay up in heaven and shout orders at us about do this, don't do this, and don't do this? Well, that looks a lot like the God of the Old Testament, right? And then God kind of said, you know, it's not working that way, and it's not going to work that way much longer. So what did God do? He said, I got to go show them. So God came to earth and he showed us. He set an example about how we are supposed to live our lives. From what I can see, as I've asked parents about what worked while you were parenting, what's kind of one principle that rises above all the other ones? And as I asked these parents this, one thing kept coming up over and over again, towards the top of everybody's list. You gotta live it. If you're going to say that they need to do it, you've got to show in your life how you do it. That's because words are heard, actions are remembered. You look at the Jewish people, the Israelites, and all throughout the Old Testament, they keep rebelling, and God says do this, and they do the opposite thing over and over and over again. How awesome is it that for us, we have the example of Jesus Christ, the life of Jesus Christ, to say, see, here's how you do it. Follow this example. So we can see Jesus' actions, not just hear his words. We can see his actions and pattern our life after those actions. Because parenting is less about what you say and more about what you do. Prioritize setting an example. Because if I tell my kid, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this, and then I do the opposite, what does that make me? That makes me a hypocrite. We use that word a lot around the church. That is the definition of hypocrite. If I tell my kid that you should do this, but I do the opposite thing, I am a hypocrite. To illustrate this idea that it's more important to show how we should live our lives to our children, more important than it is to say, I want to tell you two stories today. And they're kind of long stories, so I'm going to try to go through them quickly. And what the first story I'm going to tell you is pretty well known. The second one is connected to it, but not many as many people know it. And there's a connection between these stories, and it's going to seem like, where are you going with this, Mike? But at the end, you're going to see where I'm going with this. And it's a connection that I never realized on my own. I heard Andy Stanley once make this connection. I thought, how awesome for a parenting series. Can't wait to go there. Can't wait to tell you the stories. So the stories go like this, and the stories are found in the book of Genesis. And that's Genesis, the first book of the Hebrew Bible, or what we call the Old Testament. And it's the story of Abraham's family tree. Most of the world's religious people trace their religious heritage back to this guy named Abraham. And it takes the Bible about 35 chapters for Moses in the book of Genesis, he's the one that wrote the book of Genesis, to tell us the story of Abraham and his family tree. You see, Abraham had a son named Isaac when he was about 100 years old. And then he had a son named Jacob and another son named Esau. We'll get to Esau later. And then Jacob had 11, eventually 12 sons. But when we tell the story we're about to tell is when Jacob had 11 sons. And his 11th son was named Joseph. Now, Joseph was a special kid. In fact, Joseph was Jacob's favorite son. You know why he was Jacob's favorite son? He was Jacob's favorite son because Joseph was his favorite's wife's son. Did I mention the biblical families are screwed up? So because Rachel is Jacob's favorite wife and Rachel is Joseph's mom, Joseph's his favorite. And Joseph loved this. He flaunted this to his brothers. He's like, I'm dad's favorite. He even got this like coat of many colors thing. And he was always, in fact, he told his brothers, you know, I had a dream and God gave me the ability to interpret dreams. And in my dream, you all are going to bow down to me someday because I can interpret this dream and tell you that you're all going to bow down to me. And his brothers get fed up with it. So his brothers sell Joseph into slavery. And then they tell Joseph's dad that Joseph was killed by an animal. And Joseph's dad, Jacob, is mourning, and he's sold off into slavery, and eventually he's sold to this guy named Potiphar, and he becomes Potiphar's slave, but it's not terrible because he's Potiphar's favorite slave. And everything's going fine until Potiphar's wife comes along. And Potiphar's wife has the hots for Joseph. Joseph apparently is a really attractive guy because she can't keep her hands off of him and makes a move on Joseph. And Joseph's like, hold on, you're a married woman. I'm staying faithful to my God. I know it doesn't seem like I should stay faithful to my God because he doesn't seem very faithful to me, but I'm staying faithful to my God in this time. And he resisted Potiphar's wife. So Potiphar's wife goes to her husband, Potiphar, and says, Joseph made a move on me. So what does Potiphar do? He feels this tension in the time because, well, Joseph is his favorite. He doesn't want to really do anything about it, but he has to. So he ends up throwing Joseph in prison. So Joseph goes from being the favorite son of a wealthy guy to being in prison, a slave in prison. You would assume this is the point in the story at which Joseph just says, God has abandoned me. Forget about this. And there's a strange passage in the book of Genesis we come upon in chapter 39. It says, but the Lord was with Joseph in the prison and showed him his faithful love. And the Lord made Joseph a favorite. There's a theme here with Joseph being the favorite. Made Joseph a favorite with the prison warden. Now, God, am I supposed to be happy with this? Like, okay, I'm the favorite in prison. What is going on here, God? I'm trying to stay faithful to you, but you've got me in prison, and the consolation is that I'm the favorite with the prison warden. You know, in our lives, sometimes as parents, it can feel a little bit like we're in prison. Have you ever felt like just the routine of, well, for me, it's like diapers and feeding and diapers and feeding and sleep and diapers and feeding and puke and all that stuff over and over again. It just feels like, am I ever going to get out of this? Do I ever get a break? Like, could somebody just take my kid for a week, right? And it can feel a little bit like we're in prison. At one time, we prayed for this blessing of parenting, and now it's so hard. And then God says, but I'm with you. Just push through. I'm with you. I'm there for you. And I will be with you even when it's hard, even when it doesn't seem like I'm there. So Joseph is experiencing this while he's in prison, this tension of being frustrated about being in prison. So Joseph's in prison and he meets this guy. And this guy is the cupbearer of Pharaoh. Pharaoh is the king of Egypt, the most powerful country, nation in the world. at the time. This is like, we call the President of the United States the leader of the free world, right? Why? Because the leader of the most powerful place in the world. So Pharaoh would be the equivalent of the President of the United States in that time. So Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, has a cupbearer. And the cupbearer is the one who will taste Pharaoh's wine or drink before he drinks it to make sure nobody's poisoned it or to make sure it hasn't gone bad. So they taste it to make sure it works for the Pharaoh, and then they hand it off to Pharaoh. Well, apparently the cupbearer didn't do a very good job of bearing the cups or whatever he did wrong, and he gets thrown into prison. And Joseph meets this guy. And so when Joseph meets this guy, this guy has a dream, and Joseph's like, I can interpret dreams. Tell me your dream. I'll interpret your dream. Because God gave Joseph the ability to interpret dreams. And remember that back then, they didn't have the Holy Spirit living with them in the same way that we do now. So this is kind of one way that God talked to people through dreams. And so God gave this cupbearer a dream, and Joseph interprets the dream, and he says, your dream means that you're going to get out of prison. He says it like this: within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift you up and restore you to your position as chief cupbearer. Apparently, Pharaoh didn't only have one cupbearer. Apparently, he had a whole team of cupbearers, and he needed a chief of the cupbearers. And so he tells this guy that he's going to be restored as the cupbearer. So this guy gets all excited. Score! But then Joseph says this. He was angry as well. And please remember me and do me a favor when things go well for you. Mention me to Pharaoh so he might let me out of this place, Joseph says to the cupbearer. Listen, you can tell, Mr. Cupbearer, that I'm not from here. You can tell by my accent that I'm not an Egyptian. I don't belong here. So when you get out, would you tell Pharaoh that I'm a pretty good guy and maybe he'll pardon me and let me out of here? And sure enough, Joseph's prediction comes true. The cupbearer is released from prison. And guess what? When he gets out, he completely forgets about Joseph. Like, I know you helped me get out of prison and all that, but forget you. I'm back to tasting Pharaoh's drinks. And he forgot all about Joseph. So Joseph's in prison for a couple more years. Until one day when God gave Pharaoh a dream. And Pharaoh asks his wise men and his advisors and everybody, and he says, who can interpret this dream? God's trying to tell me, or a God is trying to tell me something through a dream. Who can tell me what it means? And sure enough, nobody knows. And Pharaoh's threatening to kill people for not knowing what the dream means. And then Mr. Smart Cupbearer dude says, oh, Pharaoh, listen, remember that time when I was in prison? Yeah, let's forget about it, all that. I deserved it. I know. Let's not go back to that time. But while I was in prison, there was this guy who interpreted my dreams. His name is Joseph. And so Pharaoh sends for Joseph, and the prison warden comes in. He's like, where's Joseph? And they bring Joseph forward, and they put earrings in his ears, and they probably put makeup on his face and give him some Egyptian tattoos or something and teach him how to walk like an Egyptian. And so he's presentable to come before Pharaoh. And so Joseph, favorite son of a wealthy guy, to servant, to now slave who's been thrown in prison in a dungeon, and now he's standing before the most powerful man in the world. And the most powerful man in the world, Pharaoh, says to Joseph, can you interpret my dream? And Joseph says quite possibly the dumbest thing you could possibly say to Pharaoh in this moment. Can you interpret my dream? Joseph says, no, I cannot. What are you talking about? He says, but my God can. Joseph, are you kidding me? Don't you realize your God has abandoned you? But Joseph stays faithful to God. And so Pharaoh tells Joseph his dream, and Joseph interprets the dream, and he says, this is what it means. It means for 7 years, Egypt is going to experience blessing. The land is going to be blessed by God. The animals are going to be blessed, and your crops are going to be blessed, and you're going to have an abundance of food. But then a famine is going to strike the land. And for 7 years, you will have a 7-year famine that will be worse than anything you've ever seen before. So for 7 years, store up everything you can to carry you through the next 7 years. And you should probably put a really good-looking, good managing guy in charge of it. So Pharaoh puts Joseph in charge of storing up food for 7 years. And sure enough, 7 years later, a famine strikes the land. And it didn't just hit Egypt. It hit all the region. And everybody needs food. So where do they have to go to get their food? The people in the whole region have to come to Egypt to buy their food. Who else has to come buy their food? Joseph's brothers. So Jacob's sons arrived in Egypt along with others to buy food. For the famine was in Canaan as well. Since Joseph was governor of all of Egypt and in charge of selling grain to all the people, it was to him that the brothers came. When they arrived, they bowed. Remember that? What happens? The brothers now are bowing before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph is like, yes! Joseph recognizes his brothers instantly. And if I'm Joseph in this moment, I'm like, I got an army at my command. I'm the second most powerful person in the second most place on planet Earth. I can command this army to wipe my brothers out and pay them back for what they did to me, right? This is how I would react. And this is what we assume that would Joseph would do. This is Joseph by this time is a 39-year-old. This is 22 years after his brothers sold him into slavery. So he's old. They don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. How do you react in this moment? Can you imagine the emotions that are coming over Joseph in this time? But he didn't strike them dead like they deserved. Joseph was alone with them, with his brothers, when he told them who he was. Then he broke down and he wept. And he embraced them, and he forgave them, and he kissed them, and he loved them. He forgave those people who did not deserve it. And that just seems insane to us. That's completely absurd. They didn't deserve it. And that seems crazy unless you know another story about Joseph. So I'm going to tell you another story about Joseph. This one's more about his father, Jacob. So there's Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Jacob has a brother named Esau. And Esau has a very distinctive characteristic. Anybody know what it is? He's hairy. Esau's super hairy. And Esau is a hunter. He's like a big, tough hunter dude. And Jacob was the cook of the family. So Esau would go out hunting and then Jacob would cook the food. And the book of Genesis tells us a story about a time that Esau went out hunting, but he didn't kill anything. And so coming up empty, goes hunting, comes back starving. He hasn't eaten. And he walks into the kitchen, and there's Jacob cooking a bowl of stew. It smells good. And Esau's like, Jacob, give me some of your stew. I'm about to die. And Jacob is the younger brother. And Jacob realizes he has an opportunity that younger brothers don't get very often, right? I've got power over my older brother. Finally, he's at my mercy, and I call the shots, right? So Jacob's like, okay, you want the bowl of stew? I'm going to start the bidding as high as I possibly can. I know if you want a bowl of stew, you got to give me your birthright. And Esau, I always wondered what's going on with Esau, and then I remembered, oh, teenager, frontal lobe not fully developed yet, right? Like no ability to delay gratification whatsoever. So Esau's like, I'm going to die if I don't get a bowl of stew. Sure, take the birthright. Now the birthright is like a legally binding blessing from the father. It's like the inheritance. The oldest in the family in this time got the big, massive chunk of the inheritance and the rest was divided among the younger people. And so Esau was first in line to receive this big inheritance from his father and this blessing from his father. And so Jacob's like, I'll take the inheritance. I'll take the blessing from dad for a bowl of stew. Esau's like, deal. Esau's not too smart. But eventually they make the deal and Esau gets his stew. And a few years later, Isaac is dying. And so Isaac is laying on his deathbed, and Jacob realizes, well, I got the birthright, but I got to go get the blessing from my father. So he put fur on his arms to make himself more hairy like his brother Esau. And he goes in to see his dad, and he's like, Dad, you're dying. It's time for you to do the blessing ceremony thing, this legally binding ceremony. And so he walks in, and his dad, he's like, well, you don't sound like Esau, but he felt his arms. He said, you feel a little bit like Esau. And he was blind at this time. And so Isaac blesses Jacob with the birthright instead of Esau. When Esau realizes what happens, he gets furious. How furious did he get? The Bible tells us. From that time on, Esau hated Jacob because their father had given Jacob the blessing. And Esau began to scheme. I will soon be mourning my father's death. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. As soon as my dad dies, I'm going to kill Jacob, and then the birthright will be mine after all. Then the Lord said to Jacob, oh, I'm jumping ahead. So Jacob, realizing that Esau, his brother, big tough hunter dude, remember, is going to kill him. So Jacob runs away. And he goes to live with his uncle. And for 20 years, he lives with his brother, with his uncle. And while he's there, Jacob, like, is blessed. Like, the blessing thing, the birthright thing, it worked. Because while he's there, he gets wealthy. He marries all these women and has all these kids and screwed up family. All these, like, animals and crops. And this guy, Jacob, is obviously blessed while he's there. But after a while, he starts to realize all this stuff, there's something missing. There's something missing. I need my family. And so one day, God tells Jacob to return to his home. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your father and grandfather and your relatives. Uh-oh. Now remember, in the land of your family, there is Esau. But I will be with you if you go. God, you better be with me because Esau's in the land of my relatives. And when he sees me, he's going to kill me. But sure enough, they take off and they take this long journey back to meet Uncle Esau and the rest of the family. And remember, at this time, Joseph is the youngest in the family. And you can imagine Joseph turning to his dad and saying, Dad, isn't Uncle Esau the one that wants to kill you? Why would we go back to see Uncle Esau? And Jacob says, God will be with us. So they make this long journey home. Then Jacob looked up and he saw Esau coming with his 400 men. In other words, Esau came with an army. And they just know it's too late to run away. They're dead. Jacob realizes they're dead. So he does the last thing he can possibly do. So he divides the children among Leah, Rachel, and his two servant wives. Screwed up family. He put the servant wives and their children at the front as a shield. And then Leah and her children next. And then Rachel and his favorite, Joseph, in the back. Screwed up family. And then Jacob goes out ahead of his family. That was right. As he approached his brothers, he bowed. Remember this scene? He bowed the ground 7 times before him. So Joseph's standing in the back of his family and he's seeing his father and Uncle Esau, who's got the army, the power to just wipe them out, right? He can do anything he wants in this moment. He can destroy Jacob for stealing everything from him. And Joseph is standing in the back watching what's happening. And he sees his dad bow before Uncle Esau. And Uncle Esau does what? Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they both wept. Who taught Jacob's sons how to bow and ask for forgiveness? Who taught Joseph how to forgive a brother who doesn't deserve to be forgiven? They learned these lessons not because their fathers taught them these lessons or because somebody taught them these lessons. They learned these lessons because they watched it being done. They saw forgiveness. They felt the emotions of forgiveness. They felt the power of what happens when one person gives forgiveness to somebody who doesn't deserve it, and it changed them. So some 30 years later, Joseph is standing before his brothers with an army with him that can wipe out, he can destroy the brothers who deserve to be killed. And what did he do? In this moment of extraordinary emotions, conflicting emotions, he chose to follow the example of his dad Jacob and his uncle Esau. And he broke down and he wept and he forgave his brothers. He said, "Brothers, I may walk like an Egyptian, but I'm your brother and I love you. Just like Uncle Esau loved Dad." And he forgave his brothers. How did Uncle Esau teach this lesson? Not by telling them, but by showing them. When it wasn't easy to show, when the emotions said do the exact opposite, he forgave. So as I live my life, I ask myself this question. What is my child going to watch me do and remember? Or I ask, what is my child going to watch me do and repeat? When your children are in times of crisis, when the emotions are telling them that they need to do the worst thing that's coming to their mind, when they're facing temptation, what you've told them may cross their mind, but what you've shown them will change their minds. What you've told them may cross their minds, but what you have shown them will change their minds. What if you are the model for how your children treat their future spouse? What if you are the model for how they will deal with temptations? What if the way you live your life is the model for how they will spend their money or how they'll organize their lives? What if you're the model for how they treat other people or how generous they are, how patient they are? Of course our actions speak louder than words. That's obvious. The whole world can see that's true. But it is so much harder to live it than just to say it. Don't take the easy way out. Words are heard and actions are remembered. Which of your actions are your kids and everyone else around you, for that matter, going to remember about you? How is your life going to echo into eternity? How is your life going to echo into the next generation and the next generation as you help your children to become who they were meant to be and they help their children to become who they were meant to be? What kind of standard are we setting? What example are we showing to our families? When we talk about parenting, we are wasting our time if all we do is talk about strategies and theories and ideas and experiences. If all we do is talk about how we should do it and how we shouldn't do it, then we are wasting our time if we have not prioritized setting an example. First and foremost, we have to show them what it looks like to seek after God with all of our hearts. God, today I thank you for those people in this room who have prioritized in their lives setting an example for their children. And I thank you for coming to this earth to show us how it's done. I thank you for coming and giving us an example and showing that it is possible to seek after God with all of our hearts. Help us to be more like you. Help us to seek after you with all of our hearts. God, I pray for those people in this room who may be hurting as a result of parents that didn't seek you first, parents that didn't set a good example. God, I pray that you will be with those people who have not done so great so far with their kids, that you will show them that your mercies are new every single morning and that you can help them to start anew today, start fresh in their journey of teaching their children how to become who they were meant to be. Help us to reflect you. We love you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for tuning in to New Life Gillette. For more information, visit us on the web at www.newlifegillette.com. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And always remember, Jesus loves you very much, and he died to give you new life.